All right. Welcome to the Cava Ships Podcast, where we try and cut through the fog and the murk, shine a bit of light on naval and maritime issues of the day. I'm Chris Cavas.
And I'm Chris Cervello.
The Cava Ships Podcast is sponsored by HII. HII is a trusted defense and technologies partner supporting all services in all domains and America's only builder of nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. HII delivering the advantage.
Coming up, around the seas, around the globe, we take a look at the maritime situation in the Black Sea, the Middle East, the South China Sea, and Baltimore with naval and international analyst Brent Sadler. But first, a look at naval news this week.
Destroyers Arleigh Burke and Kearney took part in the defense of Israel the evening of April 13th to 14th during the Iranian missile and drone attacks, the Pentagon said. The ships had been stationed off the Israeli coast in the eastern Mediterranean in anticipation of the attacks. USNI News reported on April 15th that, for the first time in combat, standard SM-3 anti-ballistic missiles were used to repel Iranian ballistic missiles. Reportedly, the two destroyers successfully launched between 3 and 7 SM-3s at the Iranian weapons. It is not clear which specific version of the SM-3 was used in the engagements. U.S. and British aircraft were confirmed as joining Israeli aircraft in beating back the attacks, but the Pentagon said aircraft from the carrier USS Dwight D. Eisenhower did not take part. The Eisenhower is thought to still be underway in the Red Sea.
A U.S. Navy P-8A Poseidon maritime patrol aircraft carried out a Taiwan Strait transit on April 17th. It was the first time this year a P-8A flew the strait, although similar missions were carried out 5 times in 2023.
The carrier USS Theodore Roosevelt joined with Japanese and Republic of Korea warships April 11th for a trilateral maritime exercise in the Western Pacific. It was the latest in a series of U.S.-Japanese-Korean exercises intended to demonstrate mutual resolve in the region.
Japan announced April 16th it would include its two largest aircraft carriers, the Izumo and Kaga, in the largest deployment to date for the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force. Joined by 2 destroyers, a frigate, an amphibious ship, submarines, and multiple aircraft, the operation, dubbed Indo-Pacific Deployment 2024, will begin May 3rd and run through mid-December. The Japanese ships will take part in multiple exercises ranging across the Indo-Pacific region, including U.S.-sponsored RIMPAC 2024 exercises near Hawaii in mid-summer. Kaga completed in late March the first phase of her conversion to operate F-35B Joint Strike Fighters, having earlier operated only helicopters, and Izumo will similarly be converted.
As we reported earlier, the amphibious assault ship Boxer, her deployment delayed by more than 2 months by several onboard problems, finally left San Diego April 1st to begin a Western Pacific deployment with the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit. But the Boxer returned to San Diego on April 11th, needing rudder repairs to continue the deployment. A week later, Navy maintenance officials were still trying to find ways to assess the damage and figure a way ahead. Meanwhile, the other 2 amphibious ships of the Amphibious Ready Group, Somerset and Harper's Ferry, were operating in the western Indo-Pacific region. Somerset left San Diego apparently on time in mid-January to begin a planned series of exercises, while Harper's Ferry was also late in deploying and did not leave the West Coast until March 19th. A recent command investigation of the Boxer found numerous leadership and maintenance problems with the ship. As a result of the problems with the Boxer, there is at the moment no deployed U.S. Navy big deck assault ship.
U.S. Navy and Marine Corps T-45C Goshawk jet training aircraft were placed on an operational pause April 15th after a T-45 experienced an in-flight engine malfunction over Mississippi on April 12th, USNI News reported. The 2-person crew of the aircraft landed with no injuries. While Naval Air Systems Command has not issued a grounding bulletin, the pause on T-45 flying operations continued into April 19th.
The U.S. Navy is set to fall short of its fiscal year 2024 recruiting goals by 6,700 sailors, Chief of Naval Personnel Vice Admiral Richard Cheeseman told Congress on April 17th, reflecting a trend the service predicted earlier this year. Even so, Cheeseman said, the Navy has 2,500 more recruits than at this time a year ago. And as he told us in January, sailor and officer retention continues to meet service goals. The Marine Corps also is on track to meet recruiting and retention goals.
In new ship news, the amphibious transport dock Richard M. McCool Jr., LPD 29, was delivered April 11th from HII Ingalls Shipbuilding. The ship is the second Flight 1 Plus variant of the LPD 17 San Antonio class and the first ship in the Navy fitted with the SPY 6 V2 radar, a smaller rotating version of the larger fixed phase array fitted on Arleigh Burke class Flight 3 destroyers.
And a keel ceremony was held April 12th for the new frigate Constellation, FFG 62, at Fincantieri Marinette Marine in Marinette, Wisconsin. And that's a look at just some of this week's naval news.
All right, it is time to move to the discussion portion of the podcast. We are joined this week by return guest and friend of the pod, retired Navy Captain Brent Sadler of the Heritage Foundation. Brent, welcome back, and thanks for joining us this week.
Yeah, it's great to be back. Looking forward to the conversation.
We were just talking before we came on air about our kind of mutual experiences at the Navy League's Sea, Air, and Space symposium held, I guess now it's 2 weeks ago. You have been out and about, you've written a lot. Let's start with kind of a broad, big picture question. What are your big picture impressions of where the Navy is right now, goods, bads, and others? You know, as we're about halfway through 2024.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're getting ready to enter political season with a presidential election. So that certainly colors a lot of the context of where Navy finds itself. And thankfully, by and large, issues that are important to the Navy and the maritime industrial base, quite frankly, in looking more broad, have been able to be kept bipartisan or non-political. So that's an important kind of context and will be a stress as we go forward. And the Navy's in the center of the vortex, deservedly so. And so why is that? Well, if you look around the world, I mean, you set aside, like, how did we get to the chaos that we're seeing? We've got a hot war in Europe. We've got multiple military operations, kinetic operations going on in the Middle East, potential major one with Iran, if we don't watch carefully, and the Navy's in the center of both of those, or at least on the periphery, or plays a role, at least in the Ukraine one, in a deterrent role. And then we've got the big issues with China, and they've been really stoking things up. So the Navy's got this operational demand, both expectation by those that are not in the Navy that it perform. Then there's the reality of all of the demands on a small force. And then you have domestic issues happening, like in Baltimore. And I know we'll talk a lot more about all of those, but operational pressures, political pressures, and an aging small fleet, that's kind of where we're at right now. And even the best of admirals and sailors and chiefs can only do so much. And I think we're starting to see, unfortunately, the system is starting to break down despite the best efforts of our sailors and officers.
So let's, I like the path you took us around. Let's start with the Black Sea and Ukraine. Some lessons learned and specific observations that you're seeing for the Navy and maritime forces.
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, the most important is if you get stuck in a ground war that is it's stuck and frozen, like attritional battle, like we see right now, the only way that you're going to be able to break out of that is by maneuver warfare, and the Navy maritime forces could do that. So that's a lesson that we could see. And Ukraine has, I think, tentatively kind of done some of this as they try to isolate the Crimea Peninsula. So that's one of the things I'm watching looking ahead, a lesson that has to be learned, has not yet been learned. But of course, mines, you know, World War I era mines are a plague in the Black Sea today. So the old is new again. The other is the value of anti-ship cruise missiles launched from shore. I mean, that point was made with the sinking of the Moskva. So while there are ways to overwhelm them or to avoid them and defend against them, the value is was made. The case was made for the danger that these cruise missiles can play. Now looking, if you look further afield, you can say the Houthis perhaps are a demonstration of the limits of those as well. But we'll set that aside.
So let's continue going, and let's dive a little deeper into the Red Sea, and then eventually let's get to the South China Sea. Your thoughts on what the Navy is learning? I mean, I have heard some that have said, hey, there's a benefit in what we're getting out of in the Red Sea. I've heard some that say, hey, we're wasting readiness, we're wasting ordnance. Your thoughts on sort of the both sides of that argument?
Well, it's a mixed bag, quite frankly. And the debates right now, this is the political season part in the context. So right now up on Capitol Hill, you have debates over supplemental bills. You have debates over the next defense budget. And those are monies that are needed to replenish the stocks. And actually, they need to be larger than they were before October 7th of last year. They need to be bigger than what they were on February 21st of 2022 before Putin invaded Ukraine. We're not starting all of this at a good place. But how our leaders are able to get the resources and make meaningful growth in the munition stockpiles, the production rate, not only just the number of munitions, but also the speed at which they can be made, especially the high-end ones like SM-2 and 3, SM-6, this needs to happen. And if that lesson is acted on, it's one thing to it's like a 10 steps for a recovering alcoholic. We're definitely past the first step of knowing we got a problem. Yeah. Now we got to do something about it. And so from my perspective, the Red Sea is only its value is if we actually do something about it. Munitions, one part. I think to Admiral Kilbrey, when he was speaking, Vice Chief of Naval Operations, when he was speaking at the Sierra Space, one thing he mentioned was that the lessons of the Houthi attacks, from 2016-15 timeframe, the Navy took on board that threat and they quietly did their homework. And so some of the success that we're seeing is a validation of the systems and the training. But again, that's not the full equation, but that's a good news story of what we're seeing in the Red Sea right now.
What's your assessment of the performance of ships? The service force clearly is performing pretty well.
Yes.
They are changing the narrative of a force that drives its own ships into other ships and has a negative impact on sailors into something else. It almost reminds me a little bit of the Army back in Desert Storm. Not to that extent or anything.
Yeah.
But, people had downgraded them and thought they weren't going to perform very well. And then they came out and did the opposite. I know at the Surface Navy Association's symposium this year in January, people were absolutely, buoyant at what was then the early successes against Houthi missiles and drones. And that became famous. Mm-hmm. The ships are still performing. The Houthi threat, it's hard to tell what's going on. They've not been firing as many missiles and drones over the last week or two. And then, of course, we had this huge Iranian attack on Israel, April 13th to 14th. We're still too close to that. I'm still not sure. I'd be interested in your thoughts on what that was, because it was telegraphed to an extent. It was had limited targets. There were apparently well over 300 objects in the air, hostile objects in the air, that the vast majority of which seemed to have been brought down. The destroyers Carty and Arleigh Burke herself, the oldest destroyer in the fleet, were stationed off of the coast of Israel in the Eastern Mediterranean. They are ballistic missile defense ships. They're equipped to shoot down ballistic missiles. And apparently they did. They used SM-3 missiles, apparently, for the very first time in combat, firing off 3 to 7 missiles between the two of them. USNI News reported that.
Yes.
That's pretty unique.
Mm-hmm.
ESSM missile has not been used to the extent that I think a lot of us might have expected it to be used. On the other hand, the Danish frigate a couple months ago apparently used it successfully in an engagement. actually in the midst of their own combat system failing and coming down, but it's still, it was with success. That's a much less expensive weapon than the standard two missiles that the U.S. destroyers seem to have been using. And actually, I was on board an amphibious ship, Carter Hall, just last week down at Little Creek. And they came home in the end of March. They were part of the Bataan Amphibious Ready Group. They came home with a nice big silhouette of a unmanned aerial vehicle on their side, on their superstructure side. So I got on board finally and said, you know, what's up with that? They shot down a Houthi UAV in the Red Sea using ESSM, I'm sorry, RAM self-defense missiles. First time in combat used for that. First time an amphib shot down something. They were sort of beaming with pride on that. And that's one of the oldest and less sophisticated combatants in the fleet. It really is. Pretty good accomplishment. So there's this growing range of accomplishments that we're hearing about, not to mention the aircraft flying from the U.S. Eisenhower, which were not engaged, specifically not engaged, according to the Pentagon, in the attacks on Israel from the in the BMD beat back. But surface force seems to be doing pretty well, notwithstanding some glaring failures.
Which are
affecting mostly the big amphibious ships. So the USS Boxer is a sort of, is a fiasco coming out of San Diego, late to deploy. They deployed, then they came back 10 days later with apparently a non-functioning rudder that they can't find a dry dock for. That is a mess. We don't have a fully deployed amphibious ready group right now, which was not the plan. They're unable to meet it. The USS Wasp trying to get out of Norfolk is the next to go in Norfolk. They're having their own maintenance issues. So it's certainly not all rosy. But in terms of, you know, combat performance, you guys are doing pretty well. You know, Roger, this isn't a full-blown kinetic exchange with a fully armed opponent, like as we might expect with the Chinese. But they're not doing too bad. What would you stepping back?
Yes. So
be of that, or is that too rosy? Don't be fooled.
Yeah, don't be fooled. I'm not sure it's uniform performance across. And there's a couple interesting things about all the things you detailed. One, so the amphib ships, I think it's not just to their class or their type. I think it's across the fleet that ships have been basically worn out. Worn very hard, and the maintenance and the supply base isn't as robust. The lack of dry dock that you mentioned is another case in point. We don't have the infrastructure to fix things or to make sure they're fixed adequately and completely, and because they got to get back out to sea too quick. And so we've been living off of borrowed time, and I think the bill's coming due. So we're starting to see systems break. Thankfully, we're not seeing people break, but perhaps we've had some of that with some mistakes in the past. Some in resulting in deaths, collisions. Of course, if you go back to the McCain and Fitzgerald come to mind, it's some of this, the human factor. But the successes you mentioned, those are systems successes. The fact that you can launch a rolling airframe missile off and take out a drone, it's a smart weapon. You just have to point it in the right direction and take it out. Same thing with the SM-2 and 3. The good engineering and design of those, quite frankly, decades-old systems are playing out. And the sailors are maintaining it and operating. They deserve full credit. But there's also an element of the systems that have been designed, the weapons. But the ships, the backbone of this whole thing, I think we're starting to see it start to, the systems, they're starting to break. And that's because we've overused, exhausted, and not replaced in a timely fashion the aging fleet. And it's only going to get worse before it gets better. And there's only so much good sailors can do to keep old ships together. Having been one of those sailors on my first submarine, to keep an old Sturgeon-class submarine going and in top fighting shape, it takes a lot of work, and there's only so much you can do. On the successes in the Red Sea also, I definitely want to do a shout-out for Admiral Brad Cooper, because he very clearly articulated very clear rules of engagement. And, you know, the proof of the pudding is that the Kearney, when it came through the Suez Canal, within hours, very confidently engaged. Didn't ask permission, just had its had their guided the commanding officer had the guidance and acted confidently. That kind of confidence in a commanding officer is important, and I take note that that means there was an understanding and a support from the fleet commander. So an important relationship demonstrated, and I think that's also that leadership is also important. And again, you can't say since one admiral is performing that way and a couple COs under them that you can assume that's everywhere. It's not uniform, but I think that's that example should be held up. And I know Admiral Cooper has now moved on from Fifth Fleet, but I attribute that some of those successes, early successes, to his leadership and the leadership of the commanding officers. And then so the other thing about Iran's attack, I actually. It was pretty clear to me that a lot of the Middle Eastern TV stations had this thing wired to the minute. So I had about four different requests to come on TV with various Middle Eastern TV stations all around the same time. And I was on Al-Had, one of the Middle Eastern stations, and I'm on there and they're talking to reporters in Iraq, and they're in southern Iraq, and they're videoing the drones fly by with the port and starboard lights flashing. They were talking about it. And they said, oh, there's Iranian coming from southern Iran, and they're flying across Iraq. I was like, whoa. And so the attack was unfolding. But poor operational execution on the part of the Iranians does not excuse what they tried to do, which was a very complex, coordinated ballistic missile, cruise missile, and massive drone attack to overwhelm and to attack Israel, to kill and to destroy. They just were not very operationally effective. Bad platforms, one thing. Bad operational plan was another. Firing your drones with like a couple hours to kill over those long distances, they were going to get identified. And then the cruise missiles also a little faster, but also pretty slow. Now you're starting to figure out where the targets are. You can figure out your vectors, fly out and shoot down the drones, then take out the cruise missiles. It allowed the Israelis a chance to go on the offense against this attack. And again, the systems played out very well on all sides. Not on the Iranian side, but on the U.S. and the Israeli side.
Let's keep working around the globe and get to Indo-PACOM. Again, I have heard folks sort of two distinct opinions. One is that, hey, all this stuff going on with Ukraine, with the Black Sea and Israel, it is causing us to take our eye off of the Indo-PACOM ball. It's a distraction. We need to refocus. That's where the main threat is. And then, as I said before, there are others that have said, no. These are good lessons that we can use in Indo-PACOM. Are both of those critiques right? Is one more right than the other from your view?
There's truth in both of those. And from our time working together back in the Pentagon, we haven't always gotten this right, maintain the balance. And so I've been watching for years now, Indo-PACOM. So Admiral Aquilino's ability to keep a couple carrier strike groups with only one small period of time where he'd exposed the Western Pacific with no carrier presence, but he's been able to maintain near consistent two carrier strike group west of the dateline in the Western Pacific. And that's not an easy feat. That requires coordinate and support from the CNO, but also the ability to win the debates of the joint staff and the global force management. So you can do all those other things in the world and learn a lot from it. And we are, but what we cannot do, especially now that you have a very confident China, is then remove your forces out of the Western Pacific to go chasing these other challenges. So it's important that the presence that we have today, that's the floor. We can't go below what we have today. It'll send the wrong message. The Chinese are looking for opportunities. That would give them an opportunity to challenge us in a way that would probably end up in drawing blood. So that's my high level assessment of how we've done things so far. And again, I bring it back to, in this case, leadership has kept us that presence.
You mentioned our time working together in the Pentagon. When we both worked for Admiral John Richardson, And at the time, Admiral Richardson put out what he called a design for maintaining maritime superiority. The foundation of that was, is that we were the superior Navy, and that he wanted to do everything he could to stay ahead of the Chinese. Last week, you put out a report entitled An Agenda for Regaining Maritime Competitiveness and Naval Power. I couldn't help but just from the title, I went in and read. But I mean, it would seem to me that if you sort of put the two next to each other, your going in position is that the Chinese have overtaken us. We've lost that bit of maritime superiority. And then you list a group of things that we need to do to maybe regain that competitiveness, regain that naval power. I wondered if you could just talk briefly about that.
So a couple of things. So a lot of my time on this issue has to do with the commercial shipping and shipbuilding, because every time I've tried to dig at how to actually help Navy shipbuilding and why we have so many problems there, the core problem, the root cause resides in the maritime industrial base. So half of that is this commercial piece. But on the military side, I mean, I roll the clock back 2015. I was just coming back to the CNO staff from 3 years at PACOM. Well, then is it now Indo-PACOM, and doing all the rebalanced Asia Pacific stuff. And so I had intimate knowledge and engagement with the Chinese when I came back to DC. And it was clear to me that they were operating with a very high operational tempo to train and to hone and improve their coordinated military operations. Joint strike, for example. Granted, a lot of it was still very scripted, but they were practicing a lot, and they were doing a lot of live fires. They were doing a lot, and so their learning curve was very steep, and it was accelerating. Our learning curve was flat and going down gradually, so we were on the wrong trajectory. And actually, in 2015, the Chinese actually grew bigger than us as a Navy. That's the truth of when you look back at the numbers. Qualitative, you can say maybe a little later, but in just numbers. Modern ship warships, they passed us in 2015. But since then, they haven't let up on their training. And we still have a way to go to kind of take it more seriously, in my mind. So we have to regain that fighting spirit. And a lot of the CNOs have talked about it, but I haven't really seen it materialize in real tangible ways. Operating ships up inside the Chinese inside the first island chain with a lot of impunity. There's some of that. And again, I go back to the leadership that we have in Hawaii right now. I think both Paparo and Aquilino have something to say about that, and Seventh Fleet Admiral right now. I think these gentlemen deserve credit for, but we need to go out and we need to actually start shooting the ordnance. We need to start practicing more large scale, not simulated, but with fleets. We need to go back to like fleet experimentation or fleet problems, where we actually are moving and testing the logistics, the navigational challenges, the communications challenges to position, and then actually shooting these systems. The folks that are getting the experience shooting right now in the Mediterranean and the Red Sea, those are a few ships. It's not the full Navy. So we need to be making sure that we have that warfighting experience and knowledge in hand, because quite frankly, if we go to war with China, the other reality is I get asked a lot, say, well, the Chinese have no experience of a blue water war. And I go, no one in living memory, maybe except for those that were survivors of Pearl Harbor and World War II, no one really has living memory of what a modern naval blue water fight would look like. No one. So we have to practice. We have to learn the fleet problems. I've been going back and studying those in the last few weeks. So I'm talking a little too much about the fleet problems of the 20s and 30s, but we're not as good as we think we are.
You never want to think you're that good.
Yes.
Doesn't matter who you are. I think some people will talk about, we are, this is a RIMPAC year. The world's largest naval exercise is about to take place, but that's not at all what you're talking about.
No,
it's very international. It's on a scale of war fighting 1 to 10, it's relatively benign. It is a lot of cooperation going on, a lot of maneuvering. But it's not the kind of war fighting exercise you're talking about, which is very rare. I think the big three carrier exercise a few years ago. It was probably the last time we
Yeah.
tried something like that. I was not war fighting or shooting live fire missiles. I worry about confrontation when people stop talking. No discussion is a bad thing. And our regular high-level communications with the Soviet, with the Chinese Navy and the military
Yeah.
has gone to zilch in the last few years. That is a very worrisome situation. I was encouraged this week when our Secretary of Defense, Mr. Austin, had his first engagement with Admiral Dong Zhen, who's the Chinese Minister of Defense. That's the first, it was a
Yeah.
teleconference. But, and that's part of this agreement where President Xi and Biden met in
Yeah.
San Francisco last November. That does make me feel a little better. I'm not getting all kumbaya about it, but little talk is better than nothing. I'd like to see the heads of navies reinstitute their relatively routine discussions. I know when Admiral Richardson was CNO, that was a regular feature. Every few months, they'd get together and say, "Well, what's going on? What's on your mind?"
Yep.
I guess in my mind, there's no negative to it. It never hurts. Don't
So,
overstep. Do you read? Does that encourage you at all? Do you see anything there, or it doesn't matter?
not necessarily a good thing. And with the Chinese, I think we need to talk more, engage more meaningfully, and for more in a more sustained way. Simply flying in an assistant secretary or a three-star admiral or CNO into for like a day and a half visit to an allied country is sends the wrong message. Like, you're like flyover territory, or you're only worth a little bit of my time. If we really want to engage and where we really need to have those deep relationships, they take a long time to build up. So when you're an admiral, it's not the right time to start, quite frankly. But spending more time with our allies, I think, is the engagement that we should focus on. When it comes to the Chinese, I've gone from one, engagement to no engagement. The reality is probably more towards the no engagement, but not zero engagement. And so I always defer back to the Chinese are very comfortable and their system is built to have the type of discussions, having been a part of these, with engaging with the capital. So the embassy, the naval attaches that are there, the defense attache, and with the right ambassador. That's the engagement, because the Chinese are going to know, are you speaking consistently with authority, and whose voice are you? And so if you have one point, it's easier for them to discern. You make it easier for their system to understand the message. That's the rub. When we come to the Chinese and we have no singular message and we're all over the map, because and that's because how we normally do business, we're free liberal society, and kind of relish that. To the Chinese, it's chaos. And so the message you might send is, hey, these guys are messed up like a soup sandwich. I mean, what the hell's going on here? Maybe they really don't care and they have no interest. And I'll give you a case where engagement didn't play out well. You roll the clock back to 2012, 13 timeframe, the Chinese start building the islands in the South China Sea. They do it very small. They do a little bit. They know we know, but we don't react in our engagements. We don't call them out. We say, hey, what the hell are you doing over here on this atoll with all your barges? What the hell is that all about? Did nothing. Engagement, State Department, Navy, DoD, zilch. Then all of a sudden, masses of dredges and ships show up and they build all these massive man-made islands in the South China Sea, ostensibly overnight. And then our engagements are, what the hell are you doing? And the response from Admiral Wu was, you saw us and you didn't say anything, so we thought you didn't care. And then when then the later then later on again with Admiral, after the Rose Guard meeting with summit with Xi and Obama, was, hey, you said you weren't going to militarize. And then the response from the Chinese is like, you know what, to us it's not militarizing, and you never really defined, and now it is, we're committed to this. Too late. This is the so the engagement. It cuts both ways with the Chinese, so you have to be very deliberate and consistent. And I think we've gotten better in dealing with the Chinese over the past 10 years or so. But engagement with the Chinese can cut both ways. Careful in how we do it, because they may come away with the wrong message or a bad message. But engagement with our friends and allies, we need to, that's where we really need to double, triple down and spend more time with them. Don't just fly in for an office call. Go fly in. If you're a senior Secretary of Defense official, like OSD, Assistant Secretary, go spend a week on an allied ship during an exercise. Go there, spend the time, go to their shipyard, see how they do maintenance, live with them for like a day or two. Be seen, be understanding of, and have that kind of empathy across too. That's the kind of engagement. I probably echo my Southeast Asian experiences there, where this was something that was always a complaint, because Southeast Asian leaders, if you came in and you just met in the office, they never took you seriously because they can never have a meaningful discussion, because the meaningful discussions occurred either on the golf course or after the dinner in the evening over cigars or drinks and stuff like that. And they wanted to know who you are first, get a feel for you. And then you actually get the real exchange. You really start to get the trust and you get that commitment. I don't think, not enough of us here in the United States, I think, have an appreciation for that kind of Asian value. So that's my 2 cents on that.
Brent, we're just about out of time, and you've been very generous with your time for us. I do want to finish up kind of working around the globe. I want to finish up in Baltimore. Lessons from the bridge collapse and the effects that that has had on, at the time, it was the largest port by volume prior to the bridge coming down. What have you taken away from that, and what should we as a larger maritime audience take away from what we've learned thus far?
Well, part of me is pissed, quite frankly, because we had a bridge fall collapse because it wasn't maintained over 10 years ago. And yet we haven't gone in and gone around and ensured all our bridges are secure. Big container ships, they've changed since 1977 when the Key Bridge was made in Baltimore. So people had to have known or asked the question, doing their jobs, to say, hey, these ships are really massive. How are we going to protect this? It's hard for me to believe that no one asked that question. And if they did, no one decided to do anything about it. So part of me is kind of pissed. So we have a homework assignment. The nation needs to get serious and need to go around and find out, hey, is our infrastructure secure, either by intentional or unintentional acts? And the other thing is, after September 11th, there's actually several laws and legislation that mandated that what I just described were to occur. And it never, apparently, ain't happening or not being enforced. So part of me is kind of pissed, and there's a lot of homework there, because Baltimore, when the Key Bridge collapsed, and I think they still are stuck inside, because you still have the bridge span still standing. I haven't gone over there to physically look at it. I will next week, probably. You can't get the USNS ships. The Navy's logistics ships are stuck. There's at least 3-4 of them stuck inside there. That's an operational hazard. If we need them, we can't get to them. So this problem is big. The other is it holds our economy at risk. So I think Baltimore was the largest car port, you know, import and export. So if you're going to buy a car and the lots are getting kind of thin, the prices are going to go up. So talk about inflationary pressures. And it's not just cars, but Baltimore is significant there, and they haven't really regained that access yet. So the other one that really drives me crazy is we've talked for years about cyber threats to shipping, and no one's mentioning that. And that tells me either we're not doing it, most likely we're not doing it. I'll assume the worst. But if we are, then it's, you know, probably there's no way of checking that due diligence is being done. So no rocks should be left unturned in this collision of the Dolly in Baltimore Harbor. And it's important that Congress, it's important that the NTSB that's doing the investigation acknowledges at some point that they did a thorough review to ensure that there was no cyber intrusions either causing or contributing to. And I say that with some experience in history, that it has been resisted because it's too hard, too ugly, don't have the expertise. we're beyond those excuses. It needs to be ruled out as well as the other things, like poor ship handling and maintenance standards.
It does, and I do have confidence this will all be part of the NTSB investigation. Of course, the problem with NTSB investigations is they're exceptionally thorough and they take a long time to actually come out. They don't like interim results. It takes a while, but
yes,
I think in terms of in infrastructure and rebuilding the nation's infrastructure and also toughening up its defenses in areas like this, there's nothing surprising. An awful lot of people have looked at this. Everything you're talking about requires a lot of money, and nobody wants to pay that bill. Nobody ever wants to pay that bill. It doesn't really matter. Yep. But, sometimes it takes exactly this sort of event to say, look, this money actually is important. Maybe we should spend it. But the portal reopened. I mean, I have a reasonable amount of confidence that the main shipping channel will be open sometime during May. It'll get better as soon as they, the shipping channel itself will be open. Ships will be able to, all those big ships can go in and out of the bridge. That's before the dolly itself is removed. At some point they will remove the dolly, which has a certain amount of damage. They'll have to deal with that. And then the bridge assessment comes and we start looking at that pier and trying to figure, is there anything left there that we can deal with? So it's going to be a long time before they replace the bridge. It won't be all that long before they actually reopen the port. Those are two different things. The port's going to reopen a lot sooner. The new bridge will be take a lot longer to build. Anyway, Brett, really, thanks for coming. It's always great to have you on. I enjoy this kind of round robin, around the globe kind of assessment. What about here, there, and everywhere? It's really good stuff. I appreciate your insight. Folks, we've been talking with Brent Sadler. He is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, former naval officer, a longtime naval and international analyst. Thanks for being back on the podcast, Brent.
Hey, thank you. It was great chatting with you guys.
Well, that does it for this week. As always, our thanks go out to Vaga Maradian and the Defense and Aerospace Group for their support.
The Cava Ships podcast is sponsored by HII. HII is the designer and operator of the U.S. Navy's live virtual constructive training enterprise, the largest LVC enterprise in the U.S. Department of Defense. HII delivering the advantage.
Be sure to follow us at Cavis Ships on Twitter. And remember, this podcast is available on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Cervello.
And I'm Chris Cavis. Thanks for listening, and bye-bye.